Morning. My name is Frederick Joyce on behalf of Moores Communications. With the court's permission, I'd like to reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. The FCC's decision-making process here can be summarized in one simple phrase: do as we say, not as we do. The FCC here said that its denial of Moores Communications' rule waiver request was necessary to promote important regulatory objectives. But in fact, those actions deprived Moores Communications of the ability to provide service to customers, while at the same time saddling this small family-owned business with a debt of $1.5 million that now they'll probably never be able to pay off because the FCC has revoked their FCC licenses. It's very hard to understand how the FCC's purported regulatory objectives match with the actions taken here. And it is that irreparable gulf between their stated regulatory intent and the harm caused by their action here that constitutes abuse of discretion and ought to be reversed. Our contention here is that this is a case of first impression, unlike other license revocation cases that have come before the court, because here the FCC is acting as more than just a regulator, more than just a license issuing entity. They're acting as a lender. And in that context, their actions make no sense at all. The stated regulatory goals that
they're acting
as
a lender, did you say?
Yes.
Because they're accepting installment payments?
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay. I mean, I'm not sure that every creditor is a lender. I owe the if I owe some payments on the vacuum cleaner I've bought, I don't think that the Hoover Company has lent me money.
The FCC here actually signed promissory notes.
Okay.
They created this scheme under the statute to be the lender of first resort.
The scheme said that you had to make timely payments with a six-month grace period, right?
That's correct, Your
Honor. And the scheme also said that cancellation was authorized if there was a failure to make timely payments, right?
Automatic.
That is correct, with important provisos, with important safety valves that are a matter of FCC precedent. That's the administrative error doctrine.
Yeah, we'll get to that. But just in terms of what everyone knew, certainly your client knew that late payment beyond the six-month grace period would put it in a difficult situation. I'm trying to figure out what the confusion was. There's a lot in your briefs about there was confusion because of the change, but the due date was not, should not have been a surprise, nor, it seems to me, should the amount due have been a surprise, although I want to hear your answer on that.
Understood. Two different issues. The due date, certainly not a surprise. As is clear from the record, our client was inordinately concerned when they didn't receive notices. Prior to this...
Where do you get inordinately concerned? All I see is that you submitted the form telling the new claims agent, or whatever the term is, Colson, where to send things.
That's prior to the due date, Your Honor.
Right.
I understand that for 5 years...
January 31 comes and goes, no one at your client calls up Colson.
They did. That's the first thing that happened.
Before January 31st?
No, not before.
Yeah, well, that's...
when the notices were
late. The due date was January 31st.
Understood. Prior to this time, for 5 years, the FCC was responsible for sending these notices. The notices all received prior to the due date. Okay.
Right. So now, I understand the kind of bait and switch with the notices point, but someone, presumably your client's company, said, we have something due on January 31st. We haven't gotten the notice yet, but...
That's right.
It's due on January 31st. We better make sure we pay this.
January 31st is a Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
The notices don't arrive. So the controller, who was designated as a recipient of those notices by the following Monday, contacts this new loan processing company. And it's important to understand the FCC had prior to then established a procedure, 5 years of sending these notices far enough in advance so that the full amounts could be paid. The amount you asked a two-part question, Judge Kavanaugh.
The
second part was the amount.
Yeah.
Now, that's not a simple matter. These are nine
stay
different...
Stay with the first one for just a minute.
Sure.
So on Monday, the controller calls...
Contacts the loan processing company,
says,
where's the notice?
So they fully knew that they should have gotten a notice because they knew they had a payment
due. Absolutely.
And they sit around and wait for the notice even though they know that they have a payment due.
Because they didn't know what amount of money to wire to this company.
That's the part I need more on.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because it seems to me the amounts were pretty clear from looking at, you know, all these tables. I mean, maybe not crystal clear, but I...
Does it change from month to month?
It does. Mm-hmm. It changed dramatically.
A lot of months it's the same as the previous month, and then it'll change after a year or something.
It was more than just a reducing balance for nine different debt amounts here. We also are into the six-month grace period, so there are two interest penalties that apply to all of these licenses, a 5% and a 10% penalty on the balances. These were not simple calculations.
What is the sense of waiting until the last day when the licenses will be canceled before asking what's the exact amount we owe?
That I don't know, Your Honor. I can't speculate.
There's nothing that suggests that it overcomes the understanding that the amounts are due on the last day and the licenses are canceled as of that day.
I don't think we've said that that's the case. I think that the client certainly understands that they knew payments were due then, but didn't know what amount to pay.
And waited until the deadline had passed to
ask. Okay. For good or for bad. The moment they got the notices, they immediately wired the money to the FCC.
And what day was that?
February the 4th, the evening of February the 4th. Again, there was an intervening weekend, so we're talking about a three-day delay. The doctrine that applies here, and the problem that I have with the SEC's decision, is that here they seem to be collapsing a licensing issue, a qualifications issue under its regulations, with the language that troubles you, which is the default language in the promissory note. And that doesn't make any sense. For 5 years, the qualifications of Morris Communications were proven. 5 years, they timely paid every single payment for nine licenses. This is a company that had been an FCC licensee for 40 years.
Do you know if any other companies had problems making payments in a timely fashion after the switch to Colson?
Yes, there's one that's a reported case here, the 21st Century case. But the reason there why the FCC ruled against that waiver applicant is because that applicant said not only were the notes confusing, but by the way, we didn't have the money to pay you anyway. We needed six or nine more months to come up with the funding. That was a waiver that occurred at the outset of the licensing process, immediately after the licenses had been issued. There is no reported case like Morris Communications.
What's the relevance of having paid for many years, and then if one then defaults? Default is always at the margin. It's never over a long. I mean, it starts at some moment, and that's when it becomes relevant and critical.
The relevance is the FCC's cited that as an impeachment of Morris Communications' basic license qualifications, and that's not the case.
Failure to pay.
Exactly.
They did fail to pay.
They did not fail because they wired the money to them. Well, again, we're talking about a three-day delay, not a failure to pay.
The commission basically held the company to the letter of its contract.
Of its promissory note, and used that as a pretext for finding them not qualified to be a licensee. That's the language in their order.
Wasn't it based in any part on their building out the two stations?
That's the irony here. They're saying that the tripwire in their regulation is to take licenses away and give them to folks who are going to construct and operate.
Constructing and operating without authorization is a pretty serious matter.
But they were authorized. They had timely submitted a request for a waiver.
Had they gotten it?
It was pending at the time that they constructed.
So why do you say they were authorized? They never got an authorization.
And they got a special temporary authorization from the FCC.
After they constructed.
Belts and suspenders.
Which is like an administrative stay while the agency figured out what was going on.
We cite in our case, Your Honor, there's not a single case that I'm familiar with where the FCC has found a licensee in violation of the Communications Act by constructing a station under a license that was properly issued to them while they're pursuing administrative review and appeal. That's an after-the-fact argument the FCC's raised in its brief for the first time that I think is
It really bad. Would be unusual to find other instances in which somebody whose license had been forfeited went ahead and built a station.
I don't think that's unusual at all, Your Honor.
Really? You know, you couldn't find any cases.
I think we do cite them in our brief. And
they just said you couldn't find any other cases where somebody who went ahead and constructed a station while their application was pending was later denied.
No, what I was trying to say, I'm sorry for the confusion, Your Honor. It would be news to me if the FCC has ever found someone under these circumstances to have violated its rules in the Communications Act. That is...
The rules against construction without authorization.
Exactly. I mean, that's just a made-up argument on their part. I'm just completely unfamiliar with the concept of not being able to construct a station that the agency issued to you when the only thing that you're pursuing is a request for review of a 3-day late payment under a promissory note that has nothing to do with your ability to provide service to the public. I mean, to make that connection, as the FCC has done to me, is just, that is unheard of. I've never heard of such a thing.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce.
May it please the Court, my name is Maureen Flood. I'm here on behalf of the Federal Communications Commission. I'd like to clarify some statements that Morris's counsel made at the outset. First and foremost, Morris's payment was not 3 days late. It was 6 months and 5 days late. The payment that Morris missed...
Well, there's a six-month grace period. I mean, that's a little...
Your Honor, there is a grace period, but when the Commission adopted grace periods in 1997, it specifically said that grace periods are not to be used as a matter of course. They're only to be used when licensees are having significant financial difficulties, and moreover, that the grace period doesn't change the payment date. So the payment due date was July 31st, 2001. I'd also like to note that Morris's counsel argues that the payment was...
If it had been paid on August 1st, would there have been authorization for the FCC to do what it did here?
No. I'd also like to clarify that Morris's counsel did say that they received the payment notices late. The FCC does not concede that the January payment notices were late. In fact, in Morris's first waiver request, they concede that the statement date on the payment notices was January 15th, 2002, and that they were postmarked on January 25th, 2002. What Morris seems to argue is that the Commission did not ensure that the payment notices reached their comptroller by January 31st, 2002. As the Commission has repeatedly said, payment notices are a courtesy. The Commission is under no obligation to send them in the first instance,
well, if
certainly.
If the amount changes from month to month, how is the licensee supposed to know what to pay without a notice?
Your Honor, the principal and interest does not change from month to month. As set forth in the amortization schedule attached to each of Morris's notes, the principal and interest amount stays the same from month to month. And so Morris knew what its debt payment deadline was and also knew the amount that was due.
So there was no ambiguity about what was due?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It's also
important. And it doesn't change on some basis yearly or what have you?
No. Basically, pursuant to the note, Morris for several years prior to the default paid interest, but just the interest payment was the same. And actually, it wasn't month to month. It was quarter to quarter. After that, they started paying principal and interest, but that amount, the amount due every quarter was the same. I would also note in this instance that the payment that caused Morris's default was the July 31st, 2001 payment. The Commission's records show, and Morris does not contest, that Morris received two prior payment notices, timely payment notices, from the Commission putting Morris on notice that they were due.
With the amount?
Yes. I would also note that Judge Kavanaugh.
Why did it take the FCC 6 years to resolve this?
Your Honor, I don't have a good answer for that question. What I can say is this.
On May 9th of 2002, the FCC sent a letter saying it would be resolved in 30 days.
The commission
took 6 years.
I understand that the delay in this case is troubling. What I would say is this: the commission has limited resources, and this case is different from other waiver cases.
Is there someone responsible at the commission for things like this, or does it just sit around in someone's desk for months and years on end?
No, it does not, Your Honor. I would say that what distinguishes this case from other waiver cases and what perhaps caused some of the delay is that Morris changed the nature of its waiver request midstream. Morris filed the first waiver request a few months after
the call. That took 6 years to decipher that? I mean, it's a little much for you to come in here with a 3-day delay. And when you sent a letter saying we're going to give you an answer in 30 days on May 9th, 2002, and then they don't hear again for years.
Your Honor, going
despite
back.
Despite repeated requests. I mean, they can't get anything out of the commission.
Your Honor, I understand, but there's nothing in the first instance. The commission didn't violate any of its rules by not getting back to Morris within 30 days. And all the commission committed to doing was either a ruling on their waiver request or letting Morris know when it would rule on the waiver request. Certainly, it's unfortunate the commission did not do that, but the commission did not violate any of its rules in failing to do that. Moreover, I note that there is no.
It didn't live up to what it said in the letter.
I agree that is the case. I will concede that fact, but that does not, the commission's delay in this case, while unfortunate, does not make the commission's ultimate decision unlawful. As we set forth in our brief, mere agency delay is not enough to establish an equitable remedy, and more specifically, the commission was under no obligation to rule on Morris's waiver request by a date certain. Going back to my original point, Morris did complicate this case in the sense that it filed its first waiver request in May 2002, but then it stopped making payments on seven of its nine licenses, after October 30th, 2002. And then in January 2003...
So about 4 months after you said they would have an answer, but...
I understand that, but, Your Honor, at all times, Morris was obligated to pay the total amount due for each license. When Morris signed those notes with the commission, it said that upon default, its debt would accelerate. Essentially, everything that Morris owed on every note came due on February 1st, 2002. So independent of its waiver request to revive its licenses, Morris still owed the commission the money for all of the licenses, and so not paying simply was not an option for Morris. I'd also note that that's what distinguishes Morris's case from other cases where an administrative error has been found and the commission is granted a waiver. In all cases, going back to our brief, in all instances where the commission has granted a waiver of the automatic cancellation rule, the commission found that the licensee on a prospective basis was willing and able to meet its payment obligations. Here, the default, when Morris defaulted on February 1st, 2002, it lost the presumption that it was the winning bidder and that it would put the spectrum to the highest and best use. Morris's actions after the fact, notably the fact that it stopped making payments on seven of the nine licenses after October 30th, 2002, and then when it filed that second waiver request in January 2003, reinforced the commission's concern that Morris would not be able to pay prospectively. If we granted a waiver to Morris in those circumstances, we'd be undercutting our regulatory objective, which is to make sure that the auction price signals that the spectrum's gone to the party that will use the spectrum to serve the public.
Well, didn't you do that when at the same time he files his second waiver request, you process this notification of build-out? Why didn't you tell him, look, you no longer have a license?
That's a fair question. Those, as I understand it, the notification of build-out form is a pro forma form. And basically, in that instance, the commission only takes action if a licensee fails to file a form. In other words, it fails to notify the commission that it met a construction deadline. In this
get a notification of build-out from someone who no longer, according to the agency, has a license.
That's correct.
And you just process it.
We did process it, and we didn't take enforcement action. But I would go back to the fact that, you know, in this situation, obviously it would have been better for all parties had the commission acted on Morris's waiver request sooner. But remember that Morris received a letter from the commission on April 26, 2002, from our Office of Managing Director, which said as follows: you are in default. Your licenses have canceled. Your debt has accelerated, and any payments you make post-default will not revive the licenses. Morris was clearly on notice, and it doesn't concede that it knew as of April 26, 2002, that those licenses had canceled.
And it sent a long letter. I mean, I'm going to hammer this again. They sent a long letter on May 2nd. And on May 9th, they get a letter back that says, this letter is acknowledging receipt of your letter. Within 30 days of this letter, we will mail you either a resolution to your item or a letter telling you when you can expect a resolution. Did that ever happen?
That did not happen.
Right. So then you're looking back to October, or they did something October. You know, you didn't comply with this.
I understand that, but the commission's, first of all, the commission's, that letter, while we failed to respond to Morris in no way, in that letter, all we committed to doing was either ruling on the request or letting them know when we would do so, but we didn't do either, but I don't think in any way, shape, or form that created a reasonable reliance interest on the part of Morris that its licenses would be revived.
I noticed, by the way, the letter also says the FCC is experiencing significant delays in mail delivery. It's not good enough for them to have the delay in mail delivery, but the FCC is having to.
Your Honor, going back to this, Morris's counsel said that there is no case on point, but that's not actually true. I would argue that this court's opinion in 21st Century Telesis is directly on point. And Judge Ginsburg was getting to some of the notice issues, which in 21st Century Telesis were the basis of the commission's denial of the waiver, a denial in nearly identical circumstances that this court affirmed. I would note that Morris, like the licensee in 21st Century Telesis, had actual and substantial notice of its payment obligations. It signed the notes, which set forth specific payments and due dates for making those payments. The licenses on their face said the failure to make timely payments would result in the cancellation of the licenses. And Morris should have known that its failure to make a full payment within the two automatic grace periods would result in the automatic cancellation of the license. I mean, that case is directly on point. I'd also like to clarify, Morris's counsel, when you asked him, Judge Kavanaugh, if any other licensees had difficulties when the commission stopped sending payment notices on its own and switched to Coulson, and he mentioned the 21st Century Telesis case. That's not the case. 21st Century Telesis occurred in 2000. The commission switched to Coulson in 2002. So the alleged uncertainty that resulted in the failed timely payment in 21st Century Telesis had nothing to do with Coulson. It was completely independent.
Well, were there other licensees?
No, there were not. Morris is the only licensee, to my knowledge, that's alleged that the Coulson switch caused this problem.
Out of how many?
I don't know. I don't know. I could, if the court's interested in that, I could supplement the record.
Not that interested.
Okay.
Further questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Wood. Mr. Joyce, you have a minute or two to new things that rebut what we just heard.
Thank you, Your Honor. The FCC is acting as if this automatic cancellation rule is some immutable law of physics, when in fact they've waived it on at least half a dozen cases. That's all we are asking for under the wait radio doctrine, for our case to be treated under the administrative error doctrine. Judge Kavanaugh, you are right on target. That 3-year delay is the white elephant romping around the courtroom in the FCC.
It is, and I'm irritated about it, but it also doesn't necessarily excuse making the late payment in the first place if you knew the date due and you knew the amount due, which I gather you knew the date due and you knew the amount due.
We concede all of that and concede that we made...
Earlier, I thought you were saying you didn't know the amount.
We didn't know we concede that the payment date deadline was missed by 3 to 5 days. We concede that there are other cases where the FCC has granted waivers of its automatic cancellation rules under circumstances far less compelling.
That's not exactly a concession.
Yeah. Very brave concession.
Yeah.
I'm also trying to win here, Your Honor. Judge Kavanaugh, this 3-year issue, it's not a mere regulatory delay. It's not the sort of thing where this court is just used to the FCC meeting deadlines. Here it had
this...
I understand. I know. Well, once in a while it happens.
This is the only agency in town that we have, on multiple occasions, as far as I know, in the last 22 years, on many occasions, issued an order to show cause in response to a request for a mandamus because of inaction on the part of the agency. So you have a sympathetic audience.
The key issue here is we're talking about a borrower. And the FCC has made a decision on timing here. If the FCC acts with any diligence within the time frame it said it would in that letter, 30 days or so, 30, 60, 90 days, then They have no reason for saying Morris Communications is not financially qualified if they act the way they said they would. Instead, and if they did that, Your Honor, your point would be addressed too. There would be no concern about the possibility of unauthorized construction. Because we would know, there's this doctrine called the Administrative Error Doctrine, and they would have an obligation to honor it. But instead, they act as if it doesn't matter. We can wait 3 years. The implications of that are astounding. It means for any agency that has a financial fiduciary duty to a company like Morris Communications, if they want to prove their point that that entity is not qualified, all they have to do is sit on that decision. Wait for the passage of time so that, of course, that company's circumstances have changed for the worse. Of course they did. They did because this agency delayed that decision for no other reason. That is arbitrary and abusive in the extreme, Your Honor. That is why that decision should be reversed, with all due respect.
Thank you, Mr. Joyce. Ms. Flood, thank you. Case is submitted.